Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. In today's episode, Professor Anthony Clark Arendt of Georgetown University discusses international law. We talk about its definitions of authority and relation with the Crimean crisis and China's air defense identification zone. Don't forget to tell a friend. We are available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave us a comment and a 5-star rating. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is in clear violation of international law. They openly mock the basic tenets of human dignity and decency. SIMSEC will be sending them a strongly worded letter. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
A small note before the show begins, in case you haven't noticed, past episode or so may have had some bad mic quality. That's my fault. I didn't check the input. We're all human. Bear with me through one more episode, and that'll be fixed next week.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. In our lives, we find there are many unseen things that regulate our movement. You could say, with the wind, you can only see it in its effect on other things. Light as well. Light is not something that you see, but rather something by which you see everything else. Such is the law. In today's podcast, in particular, the concepts of international law, international customs, traditions, and how they regulate or fail to regulate the international community. And in particular, as we have a track record here, it is an unfortunately timely and completely not on purpose podcast, considering Chinese movements with the air defense identification zone and more current, the Russian invasion of the Crimea. And here to talk about it, we have Georgetown's Professor Anthony Arendt. Sir, it is a pleasure to have you.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Now, when we begin the podcast, I always ask our guests, even if they need no introduction, to introduce themselves to our listeners. So if you would, please take a moment, introduce yourself, where you're coming from, what you think are the important beats so that our audience knows who it is that they're listening to.
So thank you. It's my pleasure. My name is Anthony Clark Arendt. I am a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University, and I focus on international law, in particular, international law dealing with the use of military force. I also direct the Master of Science in Foreign Service program at Georgetown University, which is a 2-year professional master's program for individuals wanting to go into careers in global politics.
Perfect. And if anyone is interested in further information, sir, you have a website all yourself.
Exactly. AnthonyClarkArendt.com. And I would be happy to receive any email at arenda@georgetown.edu.
Man, look at that. Office hours for non-students around the world.
It is my pleasure.
To start off, when I say international law, I'm being rather imprecise because it's not just the law as set down by, say, the United Nations or bilateral or multilateral organizations. It is norms and customs as well. And Professor, before we start the podcast, if you could lay out what is an international law, what is an international custom, and from where they derive their authority.
So international law consists of a set of rules that are binding on international actors. So is it a set of rules that are binding on international actors? Now, where there's a lot of confusion is about how international law is created. Domestic law is created by domestic legislatures, a Congress, a parliament, or the like. International law reflects the fact that we have a decentralized international system. We have a state-based system. States are sovereign. And as a consequence, international law is created in a decentralized fashion by the states themselves. States create international law. Now, how do they do this? They do this in two primary ways. First, through treaties, through written agreements which they sign. Treaties are the international equivalent of contracts. We have bilateral treaties, which you mentioned, treaties between two states, And we have multilateral treaties, treaties among more than two states. So the UN Charter is a multilateral treaty. The 1982 Convention on the Law of the Sea is a multilateral treaty. The 1944 Chicago Convention on International Civil Aviation is a multilateral treaty. And we could go on and on. So states create international law first through treaties, through these written agreements. Second, and this is a little more complex, states create international law through what is called customary international law. When we use the term customary international law, we're talking not about what states put down in writing, but what states do in practice. The idea is this. At some point historically, a state starts engaging in a particular activity. So let's say a state starts saying, you know, we're going to grant diplomatic immunity. We're not going to arrest ambassadors to our country. We're not going to molest them. We're not going to harass them. Now, the reason a state starts engaging in this practice is potentially for purely pragmatic, practical reasons. We need to maintain diplomacy. We need to maintain communication. And so it's best that we hold these ambassadors as sacrosanct. Well, this practice, which starts probably for these pragmatic reasons, continues over time, and more states start to engage in the practice. As time passes, we ultimately reach a point where the practice is universalized, so virtually all the states in the international system are engaging in that practice, or granting in this hypothetical diplomatic immunity. Then, these states which have established this universal practice begin to regard the practice as obligatory. They begin to regard the practice as required by law. That's when we can say there is a rule of customary international law. So to summarize that, for a rule of customary international law to exist, there have to be two elements. First, there has to be a practice. States have to do something. Second, there has to be a belief that the practice is obligatory or required by law. So I gave the example of diplomatic immunity. States started doing this hundreds of years ago for practical, pragmatic reasons. Over time, virtually all states started engaging in this practice. And then over time, they began to believe that the practice, began to perceive that the practice was obligatory. That's when there was a rule of customary international law. One of the most notable areas where customary international law evolved was the law of the sea. You can go back to the 1600s. There was a debate as to whether states should have sovereignty over the sea. And it went back and forth. Hugo Grotius, the Dutch international legal scholar, said no, states could be entitled to a narrow band of territorial sea, but beyond that were the high seas available for the navigation of all. Other scholars disagreed, but over time, and I always apologize for this, customary international law came to accept the Grotian notion of the ocean. That is, customary international...
That was terrible.
I know, it's awful. It's awful. But they came to accept the notion that states would have a narrow band of territorial sea in which they would enjoy sovereignty, but everything else was the high seas available to the navigation of all. Now, initially, they agreed on 3 nautical miles being the extent of the territorial sea, and it goes back to the idea that that at some point in time was historically how far out a particular artillery weapon could shoot, and there was the so-called cannon shot rule and so on. Well, that rule developed through customary law, through a practice of states such that over time it became universalized. All states were doing it, or most all states were doing it, and they began to believe that that particular rule was required by law. And this developed long before there was any treaty on international law on this particular issue. Nonetheless, as a rule of customary law, it was just as much the law as any rule established by treaty. So, to conclude, 2 ways that international law is established: through treaties and through custom. Now, one important thing about international law, and this is an area where a lot of people get confused. They say, well, gee, is it enforced all the time? How can it be the law if it's not enforced? Well, a few things can be said about that. First of all, if it is followed in practice, you know, 90-some-odd percent of the time, if it's being complied with, that, in a sense, is really the important test. And secondly, even though the law is not enforced 100% of the time, it is regarded by states and other actors that it would be legitimate to enforce these rules and enforce these laws. And there it's a little bit like, well, how many times do the police give you a ticket for driving 1 mile over the speed limit? Hardly ever, I hope. However, if they did give you a ticket, you would say, well, yeah, it's legitimate. It could be done that way. So international law, as I said, is complied with 99% of the time, and it is perceived that it would be legitimate to enforce it, even though in some circumstances it might not be. Now, it's true that some areas of international law are more controversial than others. For example, the law of the sea, one of my favorite areas, is not particularly controversial. We don't spend time talking about how far out the territorial sea goes or exclusive economic zone. International law relating to the use of military force is controversial, and there tends to be much more of a contention as to what exactly the law is in some of those areas. So that's probably enough of me telling you about international law. Let me turn you back and get you to ask some more questions.
I'm glad you used the traffic example. How many times do you get a ticket for 1 mile an hour over the speed limit? Well, let's say that you live in Los Angeles and you decide to drive a tank down the highway, or let's say drive them into, I don't know, the Crimea.
Uh-huh.
So we have these customs, we have these laws, and acting within their boundaries becomes the norm, as we understand. Mm-hmm. Now, how powerful is international law in a circumstance like, let's say, we'll start with the Crimean, and we can talk about the ADIS later, mm-hmm. because that's more about the law of the sea and, mm-hmm. and one of your expertise areas. But what about a situation like this, where the international community has a very strong norm, which is you kind of don't invade your neighbors, but because of the strength of this law, perhaps we haven't girded ourselves to enforce it so much. Perhaps you could flesh out what your perspective on the Russian invasion of Crimea and the West's reaction to it in regards to enforcing the Budapest Treaty and just general standards and norms of not invading your neighbor.
Well, it's a very good question, and a couple things I would observe. First of all, in international law, as with domestic law, compliance and power are two important factors. And the reason I use the example of domestic law, in certain domestic legal settings, if an individual actually has more power or more money, they can get a better attorney and they can make better legal arguments and they can do a variety of things. In the international system, it's even worse because there is no centralized body that works to enforce the law the same way that it does in a domestic system. I mean, you have the UN Security Council, but the five permanent members each has a veto and can effectively exempt itself from any action of the Security Council. Because of that power arrangement, there is really no way to enforce rules of international law with respect to great power, certainly not with respect to the United States, Russia, China, really Britain, France, as well, to put into that picture the whole five permanent members of the Security Council. If one of the permanent members of the Security Council is acting in clear violation of international law, there is no way, ultimately, to impose sanctions of any significant kind against that state. Now, the UN was designed that way. It was designed with a recognition that power matters, and that if you had an international organization which could enforce the law against a great power, you'd probably end up with a world war, or with a system that would not, in the end, be very effective. So, first thing to remember is power really does matter. And there may be legal rules out there, and there are going to be states that are going to be able to get away with violating those legal rules. That's the way the system is. Now, the good news is 99% of the time, those great powers want to follow those rules too, because those rules were created by states to be in their interest. So that's something to – first thing to bear in mind. Second thing is – when we talk about the law relating to the use of military force, it is actually much more complex than it is often portrayed. Typically, someone will say in a very legalist fashion that, well, Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the United Nations Charter specifically prohibits the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. So Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the UN Charter, which is a treaty, prohibits the threat or use of force against another state. In the UN Charter, there are only two exceptions to that prohibition. Force used in self-defense if an armed attack has occurred. So if the evil Canadians were to come and attack the United States, we could obviously use force in self-defense. Or the second exception to that Article 2.4 prohibition is force authorized by the Security Council. So in the case of, say, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, Security Council authorized the use of military force. And they've done that in the case of Iraq invading Kuwait. They authorized the use of force. So that would be a second exception. Now, someone will look at those charter provisions and say, well, that's very clear. So if Russia moves into Crimea without the consent of Ukraine and without an armed attack taking place against Russia or without the Security Council authorizing it, that's a clear violation of the charter. Okay. I'm not actually sure it's that clear, and here's why. International law with respect to the recourse to force has seen a very checkered past. The UN Charter was concluded in 1945. I think it was the intent of the 51 states that signed the UN Charter to establish this as a prohibition. But remember, international law is created in two ways, through treaty and through custom. So the treaty in 1945, yeah, it did seem to prohibit the use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of states. But what have we actually seen since 1945 in terms of customary practice of states? We have seen use of force after use of force after use of force. Not just by, in the old days, the Soviet Union and the United States, but by a variety of other states, making all kinds of claims. Claims that, for instance, when the Warsaw Pact invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968, the claim was, we're intervening to prevent the Czechs from reverting to capitalism, so-called Brezhnev Doctrine. Same kind of thing was applied to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. Well, the United States intervened in Grenada in 1983. It said, oh, we're intervening to promote self-determination in Grenada and to rescue American nationals and do a variety of other things. Or when we intervened in Panama in 1989, we said, well, you know, Noriega came to power and violation of his constitution, so we're intervening to promote constitutional rule there, and so on and so forth. Get the idea. I actually think that the charter framework for the recourse to force found in Article 2.4 is no longer reflected in state practice. Now, I don't think that's good. I think it's awful. But I think if we look historically at claims that states have made and uses of force that states have made, the Russian action in Crimea is really not that different from hundreds of other uses of force that have taken place since then. And then the matter gets even more complicated because of Crimea's historic connection to Russia and because of the vote that took place in the plebiscite. Now, that's a controversial argument that I am making, but I think it's an honest one. And I think it really reflects that with respect to the international law dealing with the use of force, we actually have a very primitive legal regime. It may be much more established with something like diplomatic immunity or with jurisdiction in a variety of areas. When we talk about the law relating to the recourse to force, I would argue that the international system, despite our best efforts, is still fundamentally a system of self-help. Still fundamentally a system where states, if they're so inclined, will use force for a variety of purposes and get away with it. And that, unfortunately, that has become the practice, which has become the custom, which has effectively thrown the UN Charter, with respect to that particular area and only that particular area, into question.
Would you possibly then agree or disagree that what it sounds like you're describing is that international law is nothing more than, let's say, a standard of measurement. So for day-to-day business rules or transactions, I'm using the same material. We're using the same understanding. But when it comes to what I want to do outside, it doesn't really stop anyone in particular.
So I wouldn't be that broad. I wouldn't go that far because we're dealing with the most controversial area, the use of the recourse to force. I wouldn't go that far in general for a variety of reasons. When we look at, you know, international trade law, when we look at diplomatic immunity, and I would even say when we look at the laws of war, the laws concerning the conduct of hostility, there are real restraints operating on states for a variety of reasons. States will follow the law a lot of times, even though it might be in my interest to follow it now, because they know if I disregard the law, if I shoot an ambassador, well, they're going to shoot my ambassador. It's a pure reciprocity consideration, but nonetheless, it's something that has an effect on restraining the state. Similarly, and I mentioned international trade law and a variety of other areas, there are areas where real sanctions could be imposed on you that could actually hurt, especially when you're dealing with the economic realm. And I would also argue with respect to the use of force, you know, the U.S. and Russia can get away with a lot of stuff that some other states might not be able to get away with, and that there might actually be real consequences. So I don't want to generally describe it as something that's purely transactional and that doesn't have real teeth. It has real teeth, you know, and 90% of the rules that exist out there. There are some areas, however, where you may have a public relations hit. You know, you may have some ineffectual sanctions imposed on you, but a violation will not fundamentally affect what you did. So for instance, I would argue the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a violation of Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the U.N. Charter. Now, it screwed things up politically and from a policy perspective, but it didn't really have horrible impact on the United States, you know, as a violation of the law. I mean, it helped promote a narrative that the U.S. is violating the law. It helped, you know, cause a lot of people to be irritated at us. But that's the same kind of response that we're seeing toward Russia. So even there are some consequences, but not truly significant. But I would reiterate, this is an extraordinary area where states with certain power can pull things off. The vast array of international law, that doesn't actually happen.
Just for your benefit, to emphasize, when you say no inconvenience, you mean within the legal realm, because just a lot of the listeners are military type folks.
Right.
He doesn't mean in a tactical and operational military sense. We're talking in the pure realm of the execution of international law. So black box of a state interacting in that realm, we're not talking troops on the ground and that kind of stuff, because that I don't want to create false controversy through misinterpretation here.
No, if we're going to create controversy, we might as well create legitimate controversy as opposed to false controversy.
So I just want to avoid any misinterpretation. But I'm sorry. Please continue.
Okay. No, I think that was pretty much my major point there. I will reiterate simply to say that in most areas of international law, if a state chooses to violate the law, there are consequences in international trade law, diplomatic immunity, jurisdiction. There are things that could be done to them through the legal process, and there are public relations hits that the state could take that would incline the state not to do whatever the state is doing. So there are actually a variety of things. It's more with respect to the recourse to military force where I would go. States that have the power to do it, more often than not, can get away with it simply because the international system is so structured that there's not much that can be done. Now, I would argue, and this is my point before, because of the vast uses of military force that have taken place and the violations of Article 2.4, I think state practice has effectively counteracted the legal status of that provision of the UN Charter. This is very controversial, but the claim here is that because states create the law, the treaty they created in 1945 is at variance with their practice since 1945. So at least in that area, I'd be inclined to say, well, I wouldn't only be inclined to say, I have said in writing that those charter provisions are no longer reflective of existing international law. And what we really have is an arrangement of self-help more akin to what we had before the First World War. Now, again, I don't think that's a good thing. I think that's not particularly a law-governed approach to international relations. However, I think that's where we are. And the key point I would emphasize is international law is a realist idea. It is what states create through their practice. And if through their practice they've created something completely different, then we have to go with what actually exists in practice.
You beat me to it. I was going to bring up that point for realism. So perhaps you would, and I don't know, move on, start shifting over towards talking about the ADIS, but before, is then you would say that while we create international law, it is obviously we do so in our own interest, but in the modern day sense, for the specific use of force, it is a very small constraint on what is, in actuality, a almost purely realist exercise.
I think that's correct in terms of the recourse to force. I think that's correct. I mean, if I'm trying to find some normative constraint, what I would say, and it's funny because you could almost argue the Crimea points in this direction, but when Iraq tried to annex Kuwait, everybody said you can't just take a sovereign state and annex it, and that goes too far. In the case of Crimea,
it's only part of one. It's a little part of a sovereign
state. Yeah, it's part of a sovereign state. But what complicates it there is true. First of all, they're not trying to take all of Ukraine. But what complicates it there is you actually did have a plebiscite, and you did have a parliament say they want to unite to the Soviet – to the sea. There I'm going, the Soviet Union, to Russia. A little Freudian slip there. But
absolutely.
And people said, oh, well, the referendum is – illegitimate.
If with 130% turnout, how can you argue with those numbers? That's a really passionate electorate.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, while you could argue, well, which way would they have gone? I actually think that vote probably does significantly reflect what the people there wanted because of their historical connection to Russia. So that kind of complicates it a little bit more. I think if the United States suddenly said, Panama is ours, or Cuba is now ours and completely absorbed a completely independent state, that would be rejected. But little bit here, a little bit there. I don't think it's a good idea, but I think because law is created through practice, I think it's very hard to say it is a clear violation of international law for, especially in light of the vote, for Russia to absorb Crimea.
And it definitely, I think, the language that Vladimir Putin uses, it reflects that while international law may not in some parts affect the actions of players, it certainly affects their language. You could almost say that this is a twisted version of responsibility to protect that Vladimir Putin is creating in Crimea.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's useful to challenge that because law comes about through challenge and response. And for instance, when Iran acceded to the fact that American hostages had been taken in 1979, that was clearly a violation of international law. The entire international community agreed that that was a violation of international law, but it was also important that the U.S. and others not acquiesce in that. So, you know, if somebody's going to say, hey, we're really in the responsibility to protect, I think it would be important to challenge that claim and not sort of tolerate that as an interpretation of responsibility to protect, because then that could be magnified in a variety of other conflicts. Now, that's similar to the air defense identification zones. So if China is making a claim that in order for any aircraft to fly through this extensive air defense identification zone, they have to first notify China and tell them what they're doing and all that other stuff. Well, that's clearly at variance, in my view, at variance with existing international law. Then we need, we, the United States, and we have, need to object to that. Because if over a period of time we don't object to it, then that actually gives rise to a new law. For instance, a number of years ago when Gaddafi was in power in Libya, he asserted that the Gulf of Sidra was internal waters, and he drew his famous line of death. Well, it was nonsense. It was not internal waters. There was no claim for it to be internal waters. And so the United States conducted freedom of navigation operations, both with vessels and with aircraft, over the so-called line of death. And I think that was an important action because we were saying, we're not going to tolerate this. We're not going to accept this. I mean, you can envision a circumstance where somebody makes a ridiculous claim and nobody says anything. Then over a period of years, that claim legitimates itself as a matter of international law. So that's why I think it's very important to challenge these sorts of claims. And as I said before, you do see some interesting and strange claims with respect to the law of the sea, although the whole sovereignty of the South China Sea and some of those things, too, are ridiculous. But it's important to challenge those. The nice thing about the law of the sea is that, and I said earlier it wasn't controversial. I mean, obviously the AIDS claim is a controversy, but that's a rarity. If you think of all the states in the international system and the claims they make, for the most part, it's very well established. You know, we have nowadays a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. Everybody accepts. I mean, you know, a couple renegades here, right?
The Koreans. Kind of magic special line, and the Koreans just do whatever they want.
Yeah, but I mean,
North Koreans, South Koreans are unspeakably patient with their northern neighbors.
Yes, but again, those are rarities, and you can say, well, clearly, you know, the overwhelming international community doesn't support some of those things. And for the most part, people who navigate the seas, people who engage in overflight, are very careful to respect those rules because we want other states to respect those rules with respect to us. And that's a very powerful factor in affecting compliance.
Now, you have stated publicly, and I believe you've written as well, you've spoken about the danger of red lines. Now, in these two particular cases, how does one enforce the law? I'll lay down some sort of concepts here, not concepts, but rather lay down some events. You look at an instance with the Crimea or the Aegis. In the Crimea, small example, National Geographic already shows it as part of Russia. On Google Maps, it shows it as contested territory. Wikipedia showed it as, you know, these are small, you know, examples, but for the large part, it seems as though the international community just has come to accept that this has just happened.
Right.
And in the case of the air defense identification zone, there's been more of a military response. So you did talk about freedom of navigation. Absolutely. But on the other side of that, commercial enterprises have essentially been, in large parts, recommended to comply. So
right.
Even though military vessels don't comply with it, commercial vessels do, which is moving us towards a customary way of engaging. And it, as you said at the beginning, becoming a law. How does one stem the tide?
Well, that's a very good question, because protesting a claim should not mean putting people in harm's way. And so I can understand you would say to a commercial entity, look, don't mess around because we don't want loss of life here. So there are several things to do. One is where military activities can take place, send the planes through, send the ships through, something like that, if that's appropriate. Even then, you don't want to really risk the loss of life. A second thing, however, is to simply continually protest diplomatically and to take it to international bodies, to take it to the UN, to take it to the Security Council, because those things, if done on a consistent basis, can, as a matter of law, prevent a new customary rule from developing. So I support the idea of the United – and the United States actually did that with a lot of boundaries in the Soviet Union. So Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, the U.S. never recognized that they were part of the Soviet Union, let's say. So there are certain things you can, and that doesn't mean, but we weren't, you know, invading to try to get them independence back in the day. So you can do those things, formal protests, freedom of navigation operations, if they are safe, trying to take things to diplomatic channels and the like. That can, in my view, at least prevent a new rule from developing under international law. Now, the one thing we talk about, so that's, I think, very important. But here's where the term red line gets used, and I worry about it. And that is where, as a matter of policy, a country says to another country, if you do X, Y will happen. You know, the so famous red line with respect to chemical weapons in Syria. Those type of diplomatic red lines are very dangerous because you should never say, if you do X, Y will happen, unless you're really going to do Y. Otherwise, you, the person that's claimed to draw the red line, look unreliable, or look untrustworthy, and really look like you don't know what you're doing. So it's one thing to say, we protest this legal claim, and here's how we're going to protest this legal claim. We have to be very careful about saying, if you do X, then there will be Y, unless you're really willing to do Y. And I think this was the bind, if you will, that President Obama was in with respect to Syria. Having laid down a red line, there was all this pressure on him to take some kind of action. Now, maybe there's a time and a place for that, but I think what you more often than not do is you tie your hands in such a way that you can't respond to the exigencies of the circumstance at the time. And of course, we draw red lines the other way. Dean Acheson saying, yeah, Korea is not within our security realm prior to the Korean War. Or April Glaspie saying to Saddam Hussein, yeah, we have no interest in Iraq's territorial concerns. And then Iraq goes and invades Kuwait. So I think one has to be very, very careful about drawing those kinds of red lines for diplomatic or political purposes, unless we are absolutely convinced we're going to enforce or follow through the way we've implied.
So the danger then, it is not with the red line itself. You just don't want them written in pencil. If you're going to write them, you write it in pen because you absolutely mean it. So that's really the, I think that's the crux of what you're saying.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct. I had a friend who was a policeman. He always used to say, you know, if you're going to threaten to arrest somebody, if you do that, I'll arrest you. Well, then you better arrest the person. You know, don't throw out idle claims because they have huge consequences. People will look at that as an example and say, well, they said they wouldn't do, they were going to do something here and then they didn't do it. So I guess if I do something else there, they won't do it either. And I just think that's very, very dangerous. I think you're right. Saying some things in pencil might be okay, or implying certain things could be okay, or even protesting, again, a claim under international law. But when you're making a statement that if you do X, we will then do Y, you better be prepared to do it. Otherwise, you better not make that statement because it ties your hands and limits your flexibility.
Which I think brings us deeper into that issue of international law. So we've written certain things down. We've made certain things laws, and we've accepted these customs.
Yes.
In the particular case of both Russia and China, mm-hmm. with Russia, you have a geriatric mafia state that unfortunately has an energy stranglehold on Europe. In the
Correct.
Case of China, you have a massive economy that can, for example, shut off rare earth mineral supplies to Japan anytime it wants to lodge a strong protest. We have these laws. We want these laws when we are engaged with them to have weight. But then what's the United States or the Western community or any community's course of action? So we protest and Russia says, that's cute. I have, you know, this, that's very nice. Thank you. Please put sanctions as I believe some of their politicians said, they said, we're honored. And then some of them said, hey, what about me? What am I, chopped liver? Please
exactly.
put a sanction on me as well. What do you do with that?
You know what? You may not be able to do anything. And I think that's not something people like to hear. But when you're dealing with Russia moving into Crimea, there's nothing really that we can do that won't hurt us worse. I mean, it's going to hurt, as you mentioned, given Europe's connection with respect to economic interest, gas, and the like. Europe can't do anything that won't cause more harm to it than it would to Russia. There's nothing, in my view, there's nothing you can really do. You can protest, you can lay down a protest, and even there, you should do it in such a way that the messaging is clear, that you're not looking hypocritical. You can, you know, send F-15s to Lithuania. You can reassure the Poles. You know, you can say, okay, Ukraine's not a part of NATO. You know, we understand what's going on here, but you can shore up those states that are part of NATO and say, okay, you know, we're assuring you that Article 5 really means something here. You can do that, but you really can't do that much in terms of responding directly, and that's hard. I think sometimes we think there's always something we can do, and sometimes there isn't, and sometimes we overreact, and that makes things worse. With China's in it for the long haul in a very different way. They actually have a very different conception of law, I think, in general.
Unrestricted warfare, I think, put it best. It talked about lawfare. They don't look at necessarily as rules of the game, but so much as tools to be used. I mean, we think of them
right.
In the same way, but they take a very more, I think, sinister is maybe imprecise turn. Cynical, yes.
Yes. Well, I think that's right. But I think, you know, there can be continuing engagement, and we need to have our eyes open. And, you know, we need to recognize, like, the ADIS claim, that's absurd, but we can counter it. There's not really much to do about it. We're not going to get into a shooting war with China over that. And there may be other ways in which compromises can be reached down the road. But I think in general, when you're dealing with great powers, there are some mechanisms that you may be able to use. But there may be cases where you just can't really do much. And I think it's hard, especially for Americans, because we like to do stuff. We like to respond. It's hard sometimes to say there's not much we can do here. And matter of fact, one of the reasons that people sometimes do things that are silly is because they're doing something to make themselves feel good, not necessarily something that's really going to solve a problem or change a behavior.
What do you think this shows about the concept of liberalism in international relations? So I believe the whole concept post-Cold War was Cold War is over. We have these institutions. We have these norms. These states have collapsed. They're coming back into the system, in quotes. So we will use these systems and institutions to shape the way that they move into the future. And I think that both China and Russia are very stark illustrations of how that has failed. Do you kind of have thoughts on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's correct. I think that's correct. I think the fact that we're not on a Cold War standing anymore is a good thing. The fact that the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore is a good thing. I think
for now.
Right. I think it's important to acknowledge that. I think the fact that there is some desire to engage in certain international institutions and be part of things, that's good, and we can work with that. But the Soviet Union is not a liberal state. China is not a liberal state. Law, in particular in China, law doesn't quite mean the same thing that it does here. In Russia, I mean, it's still an authoritarian regime with criminal elements in various places, conducting a lot of business. And I think, you know, openness, more investment, all those things are good, but we're not going to see a transformation there anytime soon. And so I think the most we can hope to do is not overreact, keep the dialogue going, but keep our eyes open not unduly poke either the Russians or the Chinese with sticks. Every now and then we seem to do that. That's not necessarily good. But keep our eyes open and realize that there's a lot of history that is very different from traditional Western liberalism. And to think that there could be a transformation, you know, in 20 years or even in 30 years, I think is mistaken. To reiterate, that doesn't mean one shouldn't work and one shouldn't play on their desires to be better players in the international system. I mean, China abstained from the Security Council resolution condemning Russia for invading Crimea. That's a little victory. We should celebrate it. Obviously, they have their own concerns about similar things, but we should celebrate that. So deal with the little victories, but realize that while there have been fundamental changes since the end of the Cold War, there is a lot that hasn't fundamentally changed.
Two questions from that. One, was there something else that we could have done in this? Is there a mistake that we made in our engagement? And I would then point from that. You said that, you know, it doesn't do us well to unduly poke China and Russia.
Right.
But that said, isn't that exactly what they're playing to? Is they, you know, Sun Tzu says, you know, you're supposed to loosely, you know, I'm paraphrasing a whole bunch of statements here. You define the rules of your game. You want to define where the battle is. And in our unwillingness to stand up to Russia or China in some significant way, doesn't that's letting them define where the conflict is and the nature of it. So don't we do us a disservice by not poking them harder?
I see the point, and it's a good point. The problem is that we might not be able to do that. In other words, any way in which we would try to do that might simply be counterproductive. And that is simply based on the power realities in the international system, the locations we're dealing with, and sort of the realities on the ground. Maybe there are other venues where we can do other things and have some kind of punitive impact, but sometimes you just can't do anything. Maybe the most you can do is to try to hold the line. And again, I'm not saying draw that red line, but hold things in a different place with NATO. Take certain steps there that will lead the Russians to believe that, okay, we understand what you've done in Crimea. We understand there's nothing you can do there, but do not go beyond that.
I know
that's very frustrating.
My inside of me, the American exceptionalism is raising its fist, shaking it, and saying nay to you. Let's talk about some of those options then. So you do a lot of security. This is swaying a little bit away from international law, but we'll come back. So China's relationship is very set. We know how that game is played. We already talked about the freedom navigation.
Right.
Now with Russia, punitive moves or maneuvers against Russia, in your personal general opinion, what now that this is, let's say it's done. Let's say it's done with Crimea and that's the deal. Let's not consider what's going to happen with the Cossacks or possible ethnic explosions. Explosions of ethnic conflict. Let's look at this in a black box. This has happened. What's our next step? Do we move to bring the Ukraine into NATO as a punitive move?
I think that would be bad. I think maybe we try to work with Russia to say, look, we see what happened in Ukraine, but we got to make sure that we have stability in Ukraine. We understand about your concerns in Ukraine. We're not going to try to put Ukraine in NATO, but we also don't want you to annex eastern Ukraine either. So perhaps there's an area where we can reach some kind of condominium, some kind of approach. I think if we tried to put the Ukraine in, that would be exactly what they would not want us to do, and I think that would be an example of an overreaction.
And I guess my constant conflict with that, and It's just two different ways of looking at it, is that if, like you said before, if you're drawing red lines, but you're drawing them in pencil, people will cross them. And it seems like that's what we're continuously doing. So, like with your example with Russia, if your response to them breaching your trust, not that we had much trust with them in the first
place,
is to, they cross the line and you're like, well, okay, let's work on this new line. But then that becomes an issue of respect. Then do they respect, you know, do they respect your political will? Do they respect your political culture, if you will? So the, I realize I'm asking the question again. So, I mean, are we doing ourselves a disservice? Is this mirroring? Is that really what we're doing here? Is we're hoping that Russia would react or engage the way that we would?
To some degree. Again, I understand the idea of, you know, respecting strength and a variety of other things, but, you know, we probably are already screwed up, and it's hard to get that back. And so whether I look at our response in Syria or how we've done with – how we've dealt with this particular conflict where, you know, Secretary of State comes out and says, well, there'll be consequences. And then something happens. You go, those are consequences? Those aren't really consequences. What are you doing? In a sense, we've already screwed up, and – that means it's going to be hard to get that level of respect, at least in the context of this particular conflict, back.
Then I guess that would be the crux of my question then, is do you see a path or a series of policy options that would get it back?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, my sense would be, you know, secure NATO, secure the Baltic states, make it clear to them that we're supporting. And I would actually say, cut out the silly little, let's, you know, sanction these 11 people and let's say there are serious consequences, because it sounds stupid and it doesn't really mean anything.
Well, what are we going to do? Stop them from going to Best Buy Russia? You can't sanction 11 people.
Right. I mean, and it looks silly. And so I would say, you know, and stop saying, well, it's a violation of internet, because it's not meaningful in this context. That's not conveying anything except to make us look weak, because we speak with strong words, but then we don't really do anything. So I would say just stop that kind of messaging, stop that language, you know, start sending people, and we're doing this, start, you know, sending people to Poland, send people to Czech Republic. You know, send people to Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Start carrying on those conversations. Start, you know, reassuring those people. Start sending the F-15s, whatever, but not engage in this little sort of silly, oh, we're really upset about this, and therefore we're going to do this, because that just makes it worse. Now, I think we've, you know, we've dug a hole, and it's hard to get out of it. I think the best way to get out of it is to stop the silly things and stop talking like this. Is that going to get us out of it? I don't know. I don't
know. So essentially what you're saying is it is better to not do nothing, but is it better to say nothing than say something stupid?
Absolutely.
It's really the cut and dry of it.
Absolutely.
Let's shift over. So talking about Russia, let's go back to the aid is. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard of the whole salami slicing concept,
right.
Where China sort of tries to establish these norms, these customary laws, slowly but surely in the Pacific. What are the United States options there? Because again, it's that whole more aggression, I guess, speed and surprise took us for a loop in Europe. Here in Asia and the Pacific, it's passive aggressive.
Yeah, see,
so
you can't
just hit the guy, even though you know you really should, but you can't. That's just not what.
So that's where you can. That's where show of force. You know, send the fleet in. You know, put people on some of these islands that I actually think Japan has sovereignty over. Continually do that. It's a little bit like sometimes when we've sent the fleet to the Taiwan Straits for various things. I think that kind of action is useful there. We're not using force, but we're showing force, and I think that's the important way to do it. It's not as bad, if you will, as the situation in the Crimea, but it is kind of a passive-aggressive thing. And I think just continue to say that the claims are nonsensical. Now, that could go on for years and years and years, but I think that's the kind of patient response, and not say – I mean, you say these are absurd claims, but not say stupid things, not, you know, draw red lines that you're not going to be able to follow up, but send the fleet in. You know, send aircraft through the area. You know, assure the Japanese, assure the South Koreans, whatever. And I think the Chinese understand that they can deal with us in positive ways on different levels and still have us showing force and disagreeing there.
Now, on the issue of assurance, and I'm sure you know where I'm going to go with this one. So now we're going to link the two together again. Mm-hmm. We're in Asia. We have this issue with the Chinese pressing their territorial claims, trying to pull the strings of politics with the economic routes they've set in all these different countries. Now, you look at something like Crimea and the Budapest Treaty getting tossed out of the window. What kind of difficulty does that set for us now? Because part of reassuring your allies is that the agreements you hold with other allies, or rather with anyone, are held sacred to a point. Of course, we talked at the beginning about a certain level of pragmatism that exists between the law and custom, but what do you think in the long term the effect of the Crimean crisis will be on America's politics in the Asia Pacific?
Well, so I think there it's important to signal that the circumstances are different and that we don't actually have the kind of aggression in the real sense that we've seen in the Crimea, and we're dealing with it differently than we did in Crimea. Again, I hate to be in a situation where I say, yeah, we screwed up in our messaging, we screwed up in a variety of things in Crimea, and so you don't necessarily want to go to Asia and say, hey, we screwed up there, but we're not going to screw up there here, but actions speak louder than words.
That might actually be a refreshingly effective
tactic. Maybe it would be.
Come out and say, listen, okay, everybody, let's be plain. We screwed the pooch. We're not going to do it here. I think that would almost be shocking enough to work.
Maybe it would, you know, and I mean, I might not say that in a public session, but maybe that's what you tell people. Maybe that is what you tell people. You go meet with the foreign minister and say, look, we screwed this up. Here's why we screwed it up. We screwed up the messaging. I still don't think there was really anything we could do once Putin was clear on what he was going to do. Maybe the European Union could have reacted sooner and given a different kind of fait accompli in Ukraine, but that wasn't our call. But whatever, that whole situation. So maybe that is what we do and say, hey, here's the lesson we learned from that. So you're not just saying we screwed up, but
let me ask this very quickly. I noticed you used the term screwed up on our messaging in Crimea. Now, I only bring this up because do you believe that was our key issue? Because, of course, Russia invading the Crimea, I don't know if messaging – what is it that you're trying to flesh out with that particular statement?
What I'm really – so the messaging there's messaging that – several things. One, this is a fundamental violation of international law. That's why we're upset. That's hard for that to be convincing, especially when we put it in the context of some things we've done in the past. And secondly, some of the claims about what a violation of international law is, I think, were wrong. Like, well, the Crimea is seceding in violation of its own constitution. Well, the U.S. came to power in violation of the Articles of Confederation. So there's a lot of bad things that I think are problematic there. So that's one element of the messaging, is we've made such a critical claim about international law, but we're obviously not moving to do anything about it, or it's not being dealt with the severity that one would think. The other primary problem with the messaging, too, is something I mentioned earlier, and that is that we're saying, oh, there are consequences. There are huge consequences. They're huge. Well, there haven't been, because there can't be. And so don't say you're going to impose sanctions and talk about it as though it's very serious when, again, it's, you know, 11 guys. I mean, you see what I'm saying. So that's part of the problem with the messaging.
And I'll throw in my own. When you come out, and one of the saddest things for Crimea, I think, is the watching the rationalization, where it goes, oh, no, this is Putin made a huge mistake. He'll be destroyed by this. And that's not something to celebrate, that despite your own lack of potency or your lack of competency or whatever it was that caused, you know, I'll make no claims there because that's not my central point. But when you screw up, saying that you won because the other guy screw up too, that's not a good optic.
No, that's not a good optic at all. That's a horrible optic, and we have done that. That is not a good optic.
And it shows you don't learn anything from that either. And that's the killer. Is if we walk away from Crimea going, well, you know, if countries do this sort of thing, they'll screw themselves up. Letting someone invade another country and waiting for them to meet with some sort of unknown consequences is an awful defense policy. But hey, that's just me.
And I have to say, I'm going to have to run. I hate to do that to you.
Well, is it, before you go, is there anything that you'd like to plug?
No, except
Georgetown University. Great.
Georgetown University. I've got an interesting book on some of these is Legal Rules in International Society, which I wrote.
And available on Amazon.
Available on Amazon. And my colleague Mark Lagon and I have a book which is going to be coming out in August that we edited called Human Dignity and the Future of Global Institutions. And I talk a little bit about human dignity and terrorism.
Oh.
Yes. But otherwise, I actually, this has been fantastic.
This is so much fun.
So we will talk
so much,
more.
Professor. Absolutely. This has been a pleasure.
All right, Matthew.
Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye now.
I'll record the last part. And you can find SimSec at www.CIMSEC.org, and can find us on Twitter at CIMSEC. This has been Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Join us next week. Thank you so much.